All right, so this morning we begin John's version of the Passion narrative, which runs from John 18 through chapter 19. Now, as we read through this, we'll notice a lot of similarities between the story as it's presented by John and the Synoptic Gospels, but we'll also notice some differences as well. On all the major points, the narratives align. The differences, though several, are not terribly significant, but we'll take a look at them. And so as with everything we've looked at in John, we'll be trying to glean his particular slant or emphasis in telling the story. Now, since this isn't a narrative, it doesn't have much, if any, teaching. So it's reading a story that we want to know the facts of. And so it is, though, one of the most important, if not the most important story ever told, what we're going to be reading about in these next few chapters. So the facts are significant. Regardless, we'll be moving through it at kind of a faster pace because it really doesn't take as long to read and kind of study narrative as it does teaching. Because when we're looking at teaching, it's still a lot more to explain than just kind of reading a story. So we'll be moving through this a little bit quicker than we did the farewell discourse, and certainly than we did John 17. But before we begin reading, I'd just like to say a few words about the tone of how John tells this story. Because it's a little, like I said, it's a little bit different than the synoptics. And so throughout John's recounting of the passion, Jesus is not presented as a victim. Okay, we'll see that really clearly. Now, obviously, he's not really presented as a victim in the synoptics either, but John goes way farther in presenting Jesus as the one who is in control of what's going on. Okay. And so we've seen throughout this gospel that the hour, the cross, is seen as a fate which Jesus has been willingly and even steadfastly marching toward. And it's a fate that he's willingly chosen and one that he controlled. So at his arrest, Judas doesn't hand Jesus over. Remember in the synoptics, what happens when Judas comes up? He approaches Jesus, right, and identifies him by giving him a kiss. It's not that way in John's presentation of the story. In John's presentation, Jesus goes out to the arresting party. So in other words, he's the initiator of the even though they show up, he's the initiator of the contact between the two. And Jesus asks a question, who is it that you want? And it's a question that actually parallels the very first words he speaks in John chapter 1 when the two disciples of John the Baptist come up to him and he asks them basically the same thing. Who do you want? What do you want? Now we'll see Jesus protecting his followers, so that none of them would be lost. When questioned by Pilate, Jesus makes plain that he, not the Roman governor, was the one who was in ultimate authority. On the cross, Jesus announced it's finished, which makes clear that the work or the goal that he was sent to accomplish had in fact been achieved. Now, all through the narrative, the emphasis remains on glory. Because remember, we said, where is Jesus glorified? He's glorified on the cross. And so all the narrative, the emphasis remains on glory. But there's also new emphases added of victory and sovereignty. In his recorded interrogation by Pilate, we'll see profound truths emerge about the nature of authority. And even the nature of truth itself. We'll also see the stifling power of fear as it grips and paralyzes the disciples. We'll see the revealed identity of Jesus as the King of Israel. The declaration that Pilate himself put up on the cross that here hangs the King of Israel was a coronation of sorts in a very sort of unusual way. So we'll see the role played by the Jewish authorities in all of this. Okay, and we'll see Pilate. Basically, in John's more than the others, Pilate did everything he could possibly do to let Jesus go. to affirm the innocence of Jesus, that he's not worthy of death. But as Pilate tries to release him, the Jewish authorities actually affirm their own loyalty to Caesar as their king. Can you imagine how far the Jewish mindset of the leaders had come from, God is king. All of a sudden, now they're declaring before the Roman governor of all people that their loyalty to Caesar. They actually manipulate Pilate by their questioning of him. They say, if you let this guy go, you're no friend of Caesar. And so they're in a way they're just kind of forcing his hand to make him bring forth the verdict of condemnation on Jesus. And in fact, the Jews, where we run across this term, the Jews, they're talking, it's talking about not the Jewish population in general, but the Jews being the leaders of the Jews who are bringing Jesus to the Romans. They're actually mentioned 22 times in these next two chapters, chapter 18 and 19. So from that, we can see that they held a very a very significant role in what was going on. And regardless of their complicity, when reading the story, we never lose sight of the fact that God himself is in charge, and Jesus is in submission to the plan of God the Father. And so that's kind of what we're going to be reading here in the next couple of chapters. And so let's just begin by reading the story of Jesus' arrest, beginning at the top of your page in chapter 18, verse 1. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Now, Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing that all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said, and Judas the traitor was standing there with him. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go." This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled, "I have not lost one of those you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" Then the detachment of soldiers, with its commander and the Jewish officials, arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. All right. Any questions or comments before we start digging in verse by verse?
In the other gospels,
Yeah.
didn't Jesus put the ear back?
In Luke's gospel, yes. Luke mentions that Jesus healed the servant's ear by putting it back. Yeah. And he didn't use crazy glue. Anything else? We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get down there. But all right, so let's look at John 18:1. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. All right, so the introduction ties this event to the prayer at the end of the farewell discourse. So when he had finished praying, what we've been looking at in John 17, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. Now, we had supposed that Jesus delivered that prayer of John 17 in the hearing of his disciples in the temple courts. It's kind of where it seems like he was when he was praying those things. So once he finished, Jesus led his disciples out of the city to a garden that they frequented. Now, normally they might have gone to Bethany, because remember when Jesus was ministering in Jerusalem, his base of operation was usually Bethany, the home of Lazarus and Martha and Mary. But the thing is, Bethany We're on the eve of the Jewish Passover, and Bethany was too far of a walk. It was actually against the Jewish customs to go all the way to Bethany from Jerusalem. So they would have just actually gone down the Kidron Valley and then back up to what we, John doesn't call it this, but the synoptics call it the Garden of Gethsemane. So on the east side of Jerusalem, there was this steep valley called Kidron. It was basically a dry stream bed that only had water in it in the wintertime and in the rainy season. On the opposite side of the slope, as you're going back up, there was a garden, which I said the synoptics call Gethsemane. Now, at this point in the story, the synoptics narrate what? Another prayer of Jesus, right? The one where he is. Even in Luke, it says he's sweating drops of blood because he's in agony and he's praying to the Father to have the cup, if possible, removed from him. Three of his inner circle were with him, but remember, they had difficulty staying awake. Now John, however, cites none of that, so his account continues with the description of the arresting party's arrival, verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. All right, now Judas, recall, had kind of exited the narrative when? Right at the beginning of the Last Supper, back in chapter 13, when Jesus dipped the identified him as the betrayer by dipping the bread into the sop and handing it to Judas. We're told in this gospel that what happened, Satan entered him, and then he went off to do what he intended to do, which was to betray Jesus. And now, having consummated that betrayal, Judas led a detachment of soldiers, it says, with some Jewish officials to the place where he knew Jesus was likely to be with the disciples. Now, when we read the word soldiers here, it could easily be thought that this would have been just this, because there were soldiers that were attached to the Sanhedrin. They were, they obviously didn't have authority over the Romans, but they were in charge of protecting the temple and had and the leaders of Judaism. But the word that John uses here specifically describes Romans, a Roman cohort. Okay, so it would have been a combination of Roman soldiers along with the Jewish officials that were part of this party going out to arrest Jesus. Now, the fact that the Jewish leaders were accompanied on the arrest by Roman soldiers, shows a pretty significant level of cooperation between the two. Now we'll see in a minute that they had been plotting this arrest for quite a bit. So, you wonder, okay, well, why would the Romans, want to help them out doing this? Well, whenever there was one of these festivals in Jerusalem, throngs of people would come and visit the city, and the Romans were incredibly paranoid about trouble breaking out during those times. In fact, these a garrison of Roman soldiers that were usually stationed in Caesarea would be transferred to Jerusalem for the festival precisely for the purpose of keeping the peace. And so if the Jewish leaders had gone to the Romans and said, "Hey, there's a potential troublemaker and a band of troublemakers here, and we want to arrest one of them," it makes sense that the Romans would have come along with them in order to help them out. And so for the Jews, this was the putting into action of a plan they had begun back in chapter 11. So look at the bottom of your page, chapter 11, verse 49. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish." He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Okay, so this wasn't any spur of the moment kind of thing. They had been planning it for a while, and totally intent on taking the life of Jesus. So in identifying both Jews and Romans in the arresting party, Jesus is making, John is making it clear that basically the whole world, because we've seen throughout this gospel, it's the world and its systems that's opposed to Jesus and to the gospel being worked out on the earth. And so John's making it clear that, that it's the whole world now that's aligned against the Lord. And so responsibility for what happens next, is going to lie with all of them. Now, one thing we'll see as we go through this and reading John's account of this in particular is that John is way more intent on identifying the Jewish participation in this whole thing than the synoptic gospels. In fact, there's a lot of people over the years, there's been a whole lot of anti-Semitism that's flowed out of people reading John's account of this and, and putting responsibility for the Lord's death on the Jews. Now, recently, recently meaning the last 50 years, there's kind of been a backlash against that by trying to minimize the Jewish participation in it, so as to stop anti-Semitism. But to me, that's not, that's not treating history correctly. I mean, because John does make it very clear that it's, if anything, he makes it the responsibility of the Jews more than the Romans that Jesus was put to death. So we'll just something to pay attention to as you go through, but clearly they were both involved, both, and I think the point is, it's the entirety of the world that's aligned against God and his purposes that he was trying to carry out in his son. All right. So I think it's significant that the arresting party includes both Romans and the Jewish leaders. All right, so now back to the last sentence of verse 18, chapter 18, verse 3, up at the top of your page and the end of the second paragraph. It says they were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Now, it's kind of, I like John's. Well, the other thing we're going to see is John goes into a lot more eyewitness kind of detail than the synoptics do. Because if you go back and look at the synoptic gospel accounts, they basically say the arresting party is just carrying weapons. Here, John is saying they're carrying torches first, lanterns as well, and weapons. And so as we picture this setting, it's important to realize just how dark it would have been. Because we're used to ambient light from cities, right? And there would have been no such thing. It would have been really, really dark out there in that garden. And so dark that even with torches and lanterns, it was hard to identify somebody. You wonder, okay, why does Judas have to identify Jesus with a kiss? Or it's because in a group of people, he even if you those for those who were familiar with what he looked like in the darkness, it would have been hard, so it would have taken somebody who knew him really well to be able to recognize him and walk up to him and do that. So anyway, just as you imagine that, with the scenes, our imagination is really largely formed by scenes we've seen in movies and stuff, right? And so there's lots of light in all those. It wouldn't have been that way. It wouldn't have been that way here. It would have been very dark. So now here we begin to see from John's perspective, who was, like I said, ultimately in charge of the events. All right. Now we'll notice first that Jesus was not surprised. Okay. He wasn't called off guard by what was happening. Look at verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" Okay, so in the synoptics, it was Judas that went up to Jesus to identify him as the one to arrest. But here in John's account, it's Jesus who steps forward and engages in the confrontation. So again, I think John's emphasis is on the fact that Jesus is not a victim here. He's not a victim of circumstances. He's actually the controller of the situation, and we'll see that come out even more in just a minute. "Who is it you want?" Jesus asked. Verse 5. "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. Now notice what happens when Jesus identifies himself as the one they're looking for. "I am he," Jesus said, and Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now just imagine that. Roman soldiers and all their, armor. The Jewish authorities. Jesus says, "I am he." And they stumbled back and fell to the ground. Now we've seen several times in this gospel where Jesus makes I am statements. You know, what's significant about this statement? I am he. It's one of the I am statements that Jesus makes in this gospel regarding his nature and character. And there's no doubt in any of these I am statements that he makes that he was referring to to himself using God's divine covenantal name. I am. Remember when Moses said to the Lord in the burning bush, "Who shall I tell him sent me? Tell him I am sent you." Yeah, that's God. That's the name that the Jews couldn't really speak. That was the covenant name of God. And so when Jesus said earlier in this gospel, you know, before Abraham was, I am, you know, he's claiming oneness with God by taking on the divine name for himself. Now, clearly that name carried a lot of power because when it's spoken here by Jesus, the simple mention of it causes the arresting party to draw back and fall to the ground. I am. You know, so what does that tell you? That tells you that there's no way they could have arrested Jesus if he didn't want that to be arrested. You know, he was submitting to their authority, even though he's just shown two simple words, knocked them on their rear ends. I made that more PG than what I wanted to. Not on their Roman rear ends. Yeah.
How about elaborating a little bit on the covenant name?
Yeah, well, so, you know, so that's the name that, you know, that God identified himself to the nation of Israel. It's the name that he was known by in the old covenant, the Sinai covenant. It was the name that they you know, that it was the that's the it's the name, it's the name Yahweh. It's the one that they wouldn't speak, that it was put, you know, in certain letters in such a way that you know, that it was unspeakable amongst the Jews because it was so holy.
Why would the Roman soldiers stop
What
if
would
they weren't believers?
No, I mean, I think
What
that, you
would
know, because, you know, when we talked about the name that Jesus has been given us, I mean, what we saw it, and that's the name that was given to him by God. You know, there was just tremendous, there's tremendous authority, there's power in that name. And so I think the power of the name, not the recognized authority of the name by the Jews, because you're right, that Jews wouldn't, I mean, the Romans wouldn't have, it wouldn't have mattered to them what he said the name was, but when Jesus spoke the name, the power of the words is what knocked them down. I mean, there was the authority and power on the words themselves that, you know, that just kind of would have made it clear to all who were there and paying attention who was really in charge. Now,
That's interesting. I've never put together that I am he was the I am was the key point.
yeah, right. That is the key part. I mean, it is the name. It's the power of the name as spoken by the name himself, which, you know, which knocked them down.
They're also arresting him at night.
Yeah, you know, and which they had done. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, Eddie said that they're arresting them at night. You know, once we get into the timing of the crucifixion, you know, that's one of the things that the Gospels are a little bit, that they vary a little bit in the description of the timing because, you know, when Jesus is before Pilate and it talks about the crowds, you know, shouting, "Give it, we want Barabbas," again, in the movies, we see this, you know, this big, huge group of a group of regular Jewish people, you know, who were hollering this, but, you know, but it would have been very, very early in the morning before regular folks would have even been up and about. You know, really, it's still just the contingent of you know, of leaders and authorities that were the ones doing it, along with some rabble rousers, the people who had been out in the middle of the night who they could, you know, scrounge together who were doing it. You know, it wasn't like the people of Jerusalem were doing this. It was the authorities. And so yes, it was the middle of the night. And even, and so while they take him to Annas and Caiaphas, that's in the middle of the night when they bring him over to In Mark's gospel, which gives the most clear account, Jesus is on the cross by 9 a.m. in the morning. I mean, he's already been scourged. He's been tried. He's gone before Pilate. He's been scourged. He's carried his cross, and he's actually hanging on the cross by 9 a.m. And then he dies at noon. And so, the timing of it's kind of interesting, once you start looking at that. But yes, all this is happening at night, and all that was part of the plan, because they said, we can't arrest him in public, because why? The people will rebel. The people love him.
I've heard it preached where the crowd turned on Jesus that quick. And to me, it's two different crowds. The crowd that welcomed him in, and this crowd is a different.
That's my point. Yeah, you're right. Because it's not the crowds of well-wishers who are just the normal people in Jerusalem. It's the Jewish authorities who are the ones who paraded him before Pilate and said, "No, give us Barabbas instead." Yeah. All right. So verse 7. Again, he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go." This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled: "I have not lost one of those you gave me." All right, so now we can't help but notice, Jesus taking authority here over the events, okay? Now, usually when a group comes to make an arrest, the party being arrested is passive, right? I mean, it's kind of like, all right, you got a big army of people basically wanting to arrest somebody. It's not like the arresting person being arrested is the aggressor. Jesus, though, here was not passive. He first stepped forward to engage them with his identity. Who are you looking for? Jesus of Nazareth. I am he. And that power that flowed when he spoke that name knocked the whole arresting party down. And if he hadn't yielded to being arrested, they wouldn't have been able to do it. They wouldn't have been able to arrest him if he hadn't yielded. He wouldn't, he wouldn't have been able to, they wouldn't have been able to put him on the cross if he hadn't yielded to it. Remember, he said, "All I have to do is speak the word, and a legion of angels will be here to get me down." So, Jesus is obviously submitting to this, but in the submission to it, it shows that he's actually in charge of it, of the events. All right, he's the one that's actually following the Father's plan. And so, finally, he shows his authority by protecting his followers from being arrested. Now, in doing so, he fulfilled what he himself declared back in chapter 17 in verse 12. He said, "I've not lost one of those you gave me." And here he repeats that here. Now, you might ask, well, what about Judas? Well, obviously, Judas wasn't one who the Father had given Jesus, because Judas was lost. He wasn't elect. Now, I've been starting to think about 1 Thessalonians, since that's our next book we're going to do. And right at the beginning of 1 Thessalonians, it talks about election, one of your favorite topics, Dan. So we'll talk about that then. But obviously, Judas was not part of the elect, because he was lost. He was one of the disciples, one of the ch 12 that was chosen, but he was lost. So he had not been given to Jesus by the Father. Now, and so Jesus isolated himself alone. So he asked them twice, "Who are you after?" And they answered, "Jesus of Nazareth." So you think, why is he doing that? Why does he ask him that twice? Because he's isolating himself as the only one that they're really interested in. Okay, well, you're not interested in these guys then, so let them go. So they did let the others go, and hence, he was truly functioning in this moment as the great shepherd of the sheep that he just described in John 10, who lays down his life to protect the sheep. This night, those sheep would not become the victim of wolves. I say this night because later on, most of them would become the victim of wolves, but not this night, because the shepherd was there to protect them. All right, verse 10. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear the servant's name was Malchus. Now, John's the only one who identifies Peter as the disciple who cut off the high priest's ear. If you look at the other ones, they just say one of the disciples took out a sword and cut off the servant's ear. John is also the only one who names the servant. His name's Malchus. And then when we see once in Peter's denials next week, Malchus is also a relative of one of the girls who's questioning him. And then, both Luke and John say it was the servant's right ear that was cut off. And then Luke alone chronicles Jesus healing the man's ear. All right. So verse 11, Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Now you think a sword, okay, was he carrying like this big old long sword? The word, that word for sword is actually, it's like a long knife basically that, they would have had on their belt. So it's not like a sword that we think of in terms of, a swashbuckler. They wouldn't have had that. So put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? So here we can see a connection between John's account and the synoptics regarding Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane. Because what did he pray in Gethsemane? Father, if it's possible, what? Take the cup from me. Let this cup pass. And yet, not my will be done, but yours be done. And so Jesus, in that agonizing prayer in Gethsemane, had worked through his moment of questioning, just his last struggle with what he was being asked to do. And he was now fully ready to embrace the cup of suffering, which the cross would hold. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? So, it was Peter and the other disciples who were not ready to embrace it. they were trying to keep Jesus from embracing it. But Jesus knew that the cup was both the Father's will and his destiny, this cup of suffering, which was the cross. Verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. All right, so now here John's narrative does differ from the synoptics because he adds something that the synoptics don't talk about. Because when the synoptics talk about Jesus being taken to the high priest, all they mention is Caiaphas. But John adds this interaction with Annas and really doesn't say a whole lot about being interviewed by Caiaphas. But while Jesus was being interrogated by Annas, Peter was being questioned in the courtyard. And so we'll see that. We might read that in a minute, but we'll look at it in detail next week. So what John states is that Annas was Caiaphas's father-in-law, and he was a former high priest. And both Annas and Caiaphas are very well documented in Jewish history. Okay. So they're solid historical names. Annas was the high priest from 6 AD to 15 AD. Caiaphas served from 18 AD till 36 AD. High priests, they both served a good while. Annas served for 9 years, Caiaphas for 16 years. Annas was actually removed by the governor before Pilate. There was a lot of coordination between the high priests and the Roman officials. I mean, obviously the Roman officials had the authority to remove them from office, which happened to Annas. But the Jewish people in general did not like the level of cooperation between the high priests. They had a lot of animosity towards the high priests for their relationship, because of their relationship to the Roman authorities. Now Annas was kind of a patriarch of a high priest family. Five of his sons were high priests, and his son-in-law Caiaphas were high priests at one point or another. He was the head of a pretty influential priestly family, and because of that, they were known for their wealth and their power and their greed. and not for their piety. Well, the Sanhedrin would select them, but you know, the like I said, the Roman authorities could remove them from power. Yeah.
Right. I'm getting back to Judas a minute. If God's plan unfolded here? How? I wonder what God's point. Rhetorical question. What would God's point be in the betrayal? What was he trying to show? Was Judas demon possessed or Satan possessed? Or
there's an Old Testament messianic prophecy that talks about him being one who suffered betrayal. So I think part of that is a fulfillment of that. You know, the fact that there was somebody close to him who had been the one to turn him in, you know, just shows the depth of the sorrows of Jesus' rejection. So it wasn't just the world rejecting him. It was even somebody who had been his friend who was rejecting him. And you know, you wonder, okay, well, why did Judas do that? You know, why did Judas turn on Jesus? You know, it could be that Satan, it was because of Satan, but actually, you know, if we follow the John narrative, you know, it said Satan entered him at the Last Supper. But before that, he had already met with the authorities and had planned on turning Jesus in. So what, you know, what caused him to do that? What created the opening for Satan to enter in, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Mm-hmm.
It's because Jesus was not what Judas had expected out of a Messiah. I mean, Judas had expected what all Jews had expected out of the Messiah, one who was going to come into Jerusalem, a victorious warrior to overthrow the Roman government. And now all of a sudden, you know, Judas might have been the first one who was actually listening to Jesus by saying, "No, I'm not going to overthrow Rome. I'm going to be killed by Rome." And then all of a sudden he's thinking, "Oh, wait a minute. That's not what this Messiah is supposed to be. And have I been, I've been tricked. I've been duped. I've been following somebody who's not the Messiah," is probably what his mindset was, is my speculation of it. And that caused him to change his heart and, you know, go back to, you know, the authorities and say, you know, and to turn Jesus in. And then that change of heart is what gave Satan the opportunity to enter into him to bring to fulfillment what you know, his purposes against the Messiah.
But don't you think today that similar thing happens for people who don't totally understand who Jesus is, and some trauma happens and they think, well, that's not what you're supposed to do, so
right,
you know, they turn away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, or they think that's not what God's supposed to be. You know, God's not supposed to be like this, and so mm-hmm. therefore, but it's always idolatrous. It's always an idolatrous image in one's mind of who God is, but when God shows who he really is and it conflicts with that idolatrous image, then people will fall away because of that.
Why is Judas important in this story? I mean, there was no Judas. Judas was still been killed.
Say that again.
What role did Judas play? And why was Judas in this picture?
Well, you know, because Judas played it from the perspective of the Jewish authorities. Now, Judas was the one who created an opportunity for them to arrest Jesus away from the crowds because they needed someone on the inside to identify where he was, that, you know, to show them, you know, to take them to where he was so he could be arrested under the dark of night. You know, they were
sure without Judas, they couldn't have found Jesus.
Yeah, they probably could have found him another way, but Judas was the way that they did it. So. And Jesus was, you know, I think it's significant, again, looking at it now from Jesus' perspective and the perspective of his, the betrayal of him by the Jewish systems and the world itself, you know, that was so deep, you know, it even went into the inner circle. You know, just, he was a man of sorrows and one who was betrayed by a friend. So,
going a little bit more about what we're talking about, the worldliness of what the Jews expected,
mm-hmm.
power, they wanted the power and the wealth, which is kind of the old covenant thing with Abraham all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jesus is this great reversal of weakness, you know, out of weakness and surrender to God.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's going to come to light here in this narrative is just how different the establishment of the kingdom would be accomplished than what the Jewish expectations were. Because what the Jews wanted in the kingdom and what they expected out of the Messiah was the reestablishment of life under the Davidic kingdom, you know, the heyday of Jewish nationalism when they when they did have authority and didn't have to worry about, they were the conquerors, not the conquered. They did have wealth and power, you know, under Solomon and David. Right. They wanted, and they thought the Messiah was going to bring David plus, you know, was going to be even a greater kingdom than David. And, you know, they saw all of the prophecies that talked about the nations kind of flowing to Jerusalem and bowing before the king as being a natural kind of thing. Now, Jesus, you know, when he's being questioned by Pilate, that's one of the things that comes up is just the nature of the kingdom and the nature of authority. Because Jesus says, you know, my kingdom is not of this realm. And at first, he's, you know, Pilate's asking him, are you a king? And Jesus kind of doesn't answer him. But then Jesus does answer him and say, my kingdom is not of this realm. Pilate says, oh, you are a king. He said, and Jesus says, well, you know, but not in the way, now paraphrasing, not in the way you think, because if it was in the way you think, my disciples would fight, you know, for me and to establish this kingdom. But that's not the way that the kingdom was going to be established. The kingdom was going to be established in the most unworldly sort of ways by the king being crucified.
You know, to come back to the thought of anti-Semitism because the Jews killed Jesus. It's so obvious in this story that this is God's plan.
It's God is ultimately in charge of all of this, right? You know, if you want to ask a question, who killed Jesus? Answer the question succinctly, who killed Jesus? God the Father did. I mean, there were people who, instruments and vessels on the earth that were used for that purpose, but it's all part of God's plan. It was, you know, and it wasn't a plan that was established on the fly. It was one that was created before the beginning and put into motion in the creation itself. So, the proper answer to that question, who killed Jesus, is God the Father did.
And if you don't like it, get behind me, Satan.
Right. That's right. Yeah. You know, yeah, that's what Peter is saying here, you know, so what was Peter doing when he struck this high priest servant's ear? He was trying to establish the kingdom by force, right? And Jesus said, no, I mean, it's the cup that's going to establish the kingdom. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has for me? I mean, it was the cup of suffering. It was the cross that would establish the kingdom. Well, and the resurrection. So, no, that's all good. Good questions. Good discussion. All right. So you know, unsurprisingly, these high priests who were very politically motivated, very politically powerful, very influential, filled with wealth and power and greed. And so Annas, being the patriarch of this high priestly family, so to speak, it makes sense that Jesus would have been brought to him first, maybe even by design. Caiaphas wanted, you know, and Annas conspired to have Jesus brought to him first before he was brought to the public trial of the Sanhedrin, and so that they could kind of figure out first what's going on. And so, you know, Annas was the de facto power behind Caiaphas. Now Jesus, you know, when you think about this, okay, so he'd been in the Garden of Gethsemane, which means that the soldiers had to march him back down one side of the hill, back up the other side, into the gates of Jerusalem, and all the way to the other side of the city of Jerusalem, which is where all the wealthy people lived. And that's where Annas's house would have been. So, you know, again, this is all happening in the middle of the night when everybody's asleep. And so nobody would have noticed it except for the evil and wicked people who might have been out that that time of night.
That's a good law. If you've been there, well, that's a good law.
Yeah.
Down into that valley and back up the other side.
Yeah, and then across town. Now it's interesting, you know, Annas was still being called the high priest because he's kind of like the ex-president. You still call him president, whatever. You know, and once you're the high priest, you're still called the high priest. So Annas is the high priest here. And as we follow through John's narrative next week, when he's being questioned, all the references to the high priest would have been Annas and not Caiaphas. That goes all the way down to verse 24. So all of the questioning by Jesus, of Jesus by the high priest, which we'll look at next week, would have been done by Annas.
I just looked up his name.
Uh-huh.
It means the one who answers.
Oh, really?
And maybe. Malchus was one, it means my king.
My king.
Kingdom, yeah. And counselor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting that Malchus is named that way. All right. So next week we're going to look at Peter's denial and this questioning of Jesus by Annas. Jesus had predicted Peter's denial, which we'll start by looking at. That's on the back of your page. It's almost 8 now, so we'll just stop here. This is a good breaking point, and then we'll look at Peter's denial next week and the questioning of Jesus by Annas. Any other questions or comments?
It just struck me. The high priest was selected by the Sanhedrin by a vote. And the correlation between that and the Catholic Church was the College of Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
Selects the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much the same deal.
And then the Sanhedrin was like, well, it's the College of Cardinals.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, Lord, we thank you for who you are. Thank you for what you've accomplished on our behalf, Lord. Thank you that you were willing to drink the cup needed to bring about forgiveness for us, to bring about our salvation, to bring in and to inaugurate your glorious kingdom, Lord. Lord, as we read through this, I pray that you would give us the grace to not look at what we're reading with worldly eyes, the way that everybody else was appraising it, Lord. I pray that we would see things from your perspective and that we would appreciate what it is that you were accomplishing and the way that you were accomplishing it, Lord. Thank you, Jesus, that even though you possessed all authority to keep this from happening, you allowed it to be so. Thank you, Father, that you sent your Son to suffer what must have been horrible for you to imagine and to witness and to allow, but you did because Jesus is the great shepherd of the sheep who laid down his life for us that we might live and that we might be united and connected to you. And so, Lord, as you know, we're all so familiar with this story, but as we read it, Lord, I pray you just give us fresh insight and appreciation for everything that you've accomplished in and through your Son. We pray this in his mighty name. Amen.
God knew the end of the story.